This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Margaret Ratner-Kunstler joins us for a special Lawyers You'll Like interview with attorney Abdeen Jabara.
Abdeen found a way to integrate his private law practice and activities in support of Palestinians over the last 50 years. Give a listen on what he's accomplished.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Smith, the Department of Justice is actually suing Volkswagen on behalf of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, they are, but only as a civil suit. They're only asking for money. Heidi, if you or I or Michael were in that office, we'd be trying to put these people in prison, and I'll tell you why. The executives at Volkswagen tricked out the computers so they could fool testers into thinking that the diesel engine cars that they sold to Americans, and we're talking over 600,000 cars, were not polluting to the extent they did. These diesel engine cars released 30.2 million tons, not pounds, tons of heat-entrapping gases into our planet. They also released thousands of tons of nitrous oxide, which caused asthma in children and old people and other damaging lung tissue diseases. These people have committed a crime against the planet, a crime against humanity, and what are they going to do? They're going to get a fine. What does it show? It shows the same thing when the banksters who crashed the economy in 2008 were let off the hook, and not a single one of them was put into prison. Everybody lost their homes. People lost jobs. It was a disaster we're just climbing out of, and nothing was done to them. There's a two-tier system of justice in this country. I used to be a member of the Labor Party, and Tony Mazzocchi used to say, the bosses have two parties and we have none. And that's the problem. We have none, and both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party just slap the wrists of the corporations that control them. Occasionally, Law and Disorder features a poet, and in this case, we have our friend, the Chicago activist Bill Ayer, who's not exactly a poet, but he has a mediation kind of New Year's resolution that he wrote up, and I'd like it if you could please read it to our listeners to start the new year.
Welcome 2016. So long 2015. All your surprises, twists and turns, heartbreak and hope are behind us now. Whatever was possible is done. Fresh surprises are up ahead and new vistas are opening. Do you see that small figure gesturing wildly from that distant and indistinct shore? Let's dive into that wreckage. Let's dive into the wreckage and swim as hard as we can in the direction of our dreams. Let's stay all the way human. I'll try hard in 2016 to be guided by the rhythm of activism. Open your eyes and pay attention. Be astonished at the beauty and the ecstasy, as well as the unnecessary pain and suffering all around. Do something about it. Say something about it. Act out. Write it down. Rise up. Doubt. Rethink. And start again. Repeat, repeat, repeat. I'll try to talk to strangers every day. Knock on doors, read everything, distribute information, display my politics in the public square. Listen as hard as I can with the possibility of being changed, and speak as clearly as I can with the possibility of being heard. Learn from my mentors. Follow the young. Take to the streets. Fight the power. Encounter art. Eat only what I need. Ride my bike everywhere. Dance the dialectic. House the homeless. Stand up for joy and justice, peace and love. Another world is surely coming. But there are no guarantees that it will be a better world. Work camps and slave states are possible, and nuclear war is possible. But so is peace and freedom. The choices are stark. Socialism or barbarism. Chaos or community. The end of capitalism or the end of the earth. We had better get busy. I'll do my best in 2016 to build the movement for peace in this Spartan military garrison, for racial justice and freedom in this bastion of white supremacy, for economic justice in the heartland of predatory zombie capitalism, for women's equality and gender justice in this male supremacist bazaar. And that's not all. Black Lives Matter, Free Palestine, women's full equality, Save the Planet, full rights for immigrants, education matters, free minds, free people. Children's rights are human rights.
Thank you, Bill Ayers, for sitting down at 6 a.m. on January 1st of 2016 and composing that for us.
Abdin Jabara is a New York-based civil rights attorney and co-founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. He was involved in a groundbreaking court case in the 1970s that forced the NSA to acknowledge it had been spying on him since 1967. At the time of the spying, Abdin was a lawyer in Detroit representing Arab-American clients and persons being charged by the FBI. The disclosure marked the first time the NSA admitted it had spied on an American. Abdin also took on the cases of people harassed by the FBI, which had stepped up efforts to surveil Arab activists in the aftermath of the 1967 war, when the U.S. alliance with Israel was solidified. Abdin was caught up in what was called Operation Boulder, a Nixon administration-era program that placed Arabs under surveillance in this country. Abdin is a member of the Legal Advisory Board for the American Muslim Council, a past president of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, a former board member of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and former co-counsel, with Lynn Stewart, for Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. He is an active member of the National Lawyers Guild.
Attorney Abdin Jabara, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here, Michael.
I'm sitting here with my good friend and colleague and comrade, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, who's a civil rights attorney here in New York City, longtime civil rights attorney, at one time was associated, as I was, with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Margaret, glad to have you with me.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Yeah, you know, I wanted to start at the beginning, Abdin. There are many forces that make everybody who they are, and your forces are particularly interesting to me. I mean, you grew up in a small community in northern Michigan in the 40s and the 50s, and that was an interesting time to be growing up. And so what was it that made you develop into the human being that you are? You went through the civil rights movement, and a number of movements, and your childhood background. Give us a sense of how all of those things made you start to develop.
Well, I grew up in an ethnic family in this small town. My mother and father had both immigrated here from Lebanon. My maternal grandfather had actually come to North Dakota in the latter part of the 19th century and homesteaded there. And his first daughter, who was born in Lebanon, who was my mother, came as a three-year-old with her mother in 1906, and then married my father in 1923 in Minneapolis. And they settled back in this small town where my father had had a business and raised a family of seven children there, of which I was the youngest. We were one of two Arab families in the town. At the time, we thought we were Syrian, I guess, and we didn't. But that area had just been broken up by the colonial powers, and I was coming to an understanding of what had happened in the region after the First World War and what Britain and France had done in the League of Nations, etc., and also the creation of Israel. My family was in a grocery business, and I worked in that business. And then the very traumatic experience happened when my father was killed in an automobile accident. I was with him. I was 10 years old. So that had a very big impact on me. I really didn't know him as an adult. I knew him only then. And he had a very strong ethnic identity. He was not afraid to speak Arabic to my older siblings in front of customers in the store, although they cringed when he did that. And he would sometimes draw a map of the Middle East when people would ask him, "Where are you from?" He'd draw it on a carton and one of the boxes and so forth to show them. So that is the kind of a memory that I had. And I also had one other really strong memory about my father, and that was him leaning down to listen to the shortwave radio in 1948. I would have been 8 years old this time. Now, he was listening to some Arabic radio program, which I didn't understand, and only later on did I understand that what he was following was the incredible turmoil that was happening in Palestine and so forth. Well, I went on. I worked in our family store, went away to university at the University of Michigan in 1958 after I finished high school. There were 34 in my graduating class. They had a language requirement. They said, you got to take some foreign language. So even though I only knew maybe 100 words in Arabic that I'd picked up, some of which were cuss words.
And it's like me and Margaret with Yiddish.
So I said, I'll take Arabic. And I studied Arabic for 2 years. And then I decided, well, I'm not going to learn it this way. I'm going to have to do some immersion tactics. And I just pulled up and went to Egypt for 6 months and spent 6 months in Egypt. And I lived with the family of my sister's husband, my brother-in-law. And I spent 6 months there, and it was really quite a culture shock being there, because after being in the small town in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then going to Egypt and finding poverty and all those problems, and it was during the period of Arab nationalism, and Nasser was in power in Egypt at the time. And I spent 6 months there, and then I traveled to Lebanon for my first visit, and I visited both my mother's and father's villages, and then went up to Aleppo and took the Orient Express from Aleppo all the way up to England and then back to the United States. And I got back into finish my undergrad, and then when I finished that, I was taking pre-legal studies and then went on to law school at the Wayne State University.
Abdin, what role did the civil rights movement and then the anti-Vietnam War movement have in shaping your views?
It had an enormous effect. When I was in law school, it was a time of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, and it was the students at the law school were very conservative. I started a chapter of the Law Student Civil Rights Research Council while I was in law school. I also clerked for Ernest Goodman, who was trying to revive the National Lawyers Guild at the time that had been really quite decimated by the McCarthy period. And they were sending lawyers down to the South to work in the civil rights movement. Claudia Morcom, who became a judge, she was African-American attorney in Detroit in the Goodman firm, and I clerked for him for about a year and a half, and it was an incredibly important period in my education. So my activity at Wayne, we brought Malcolm X to speak, we brought Herbert Aptekar to speak, and this was incredible because this was way out for the law school, and we brought them to speak, and it was quite an experience. So after I finished law school, I had to study for the bar, but they were having an intensive summer Arabic program at the University of Michigan that same summer, so I said, to hell with it, I can handle both of them. And they didn't normally have it there, and I would only have to pay in-state tuition. So I lived in Plymouth, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit, and would go to classes, and it was very intensive. You had to go to the language lab and all that stuff and so forth. And by the end of the summer, after taking the bar exam, I was totally wiped out, and I said, to hell with it. I don't want to go to work. I don't want to get involved in a rat race. So some of these people at this summer program had gone off to a special language school in Lebanon. So I went there, too. So I spent 4 months at that school, and then the tuition was too high, and I went down to Beirut, and I worked for the Palestine Research Center, writing a monograph.
What did you do for them?
I wrote a monograph about the Egyptian-Israeli armistice agreement. And Beirut at the time was a La Dolce Vita atmosphere. It was called the Switzerland of the Middle East, and it was being there was an incredible experience. And after I finished that, I couldn't find any other employment. I didn't want to go back to the United States. I made my way to Paris. I tried to find a job in Paris. I couldn't find one there. So I came back, and I opened my law practice, a solo law practice in Detroit, because I'd learned how to handle personal injury cases. I said, I'll use that as my basis for my work.
Well, after you opened up your law office in Detroit, Abdeen, the 1967 Arab-Israeli War broke out. And was that a turning point in your consciousness and activity?
My goodness gracious, I cannot tell you how big of a turning point it was. Here I was settled into trying to earn a living in practicing law. One of the reasons I opened in Detroit is because they had a fairly large Arab community. It wasn't nearly as large as it is today. And I thought, well, I can get some clients there because of my speaking Arabic and so forth. I had to find some kind of basis. And what happened was this, it was 66, I opened my practice, and then Detroit had this huge uprising of the black population in 1967 at the same time as the war in the Middle East, the so-called Six-Day War, so-called Arab-Israeli War. It has many different names. Well, both of those were incredible experiences that I experienced while just starting out there. And two members of the Lawyers Guild, I was the secretary of the chapter there in Detroit, and two of the members of the Lawyers Guild called a special meeting not to discuss the burning and the police violence in Detroit, but to have the Lawyers Guild send letters to the Soviet Union to protest their supplying arms to the Arab countries. And so we had this special meeting. They wanted to expel me from the Lawyers Guild, these two members, and they had this special meeting. I will never forget it. It was in the Cadillac Tower. Bill Goodman was there, who's I just saw this past weekend as a dear friend. He defended me. Of course, I was not expelled. They withdrew, actually, from the Lawyers Guild. One of them was Bernie Feiger, the father of the famous attorney in Detroit, who has nothing to do with the Lawyers Guild. So, and then following that, I mean, this, there was a meeting of the International Orientalist Society in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan. And one of the professors at the University of Michigan invited me to attend a meeting. And all these people that attended this meeting, they're all Arab professors in different universities in the United States, and they were totally devastated. And they said, what can we do? This is terrible, and so forth. And that is when my first organizing effort in the Arab American community started. It was with the creation of something called the Association of Arab American University Graduates, which from 1968 until the creation of ADC in 1980.
ADC is what?
The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. It was the principal national Arab American organization, but it was still restricted to, number one, university graduates, and it was very academic in its approach, holding these conferences and bringing in eminent speakers from overseas, et cetera, to speak and so forth. But that was a lot of my, and I served as the president of that organization in 1972. I was the original founding secretary of the organization, and I had a lot of time in my office, so that's what I spent a lot of time on.
Let me ask you this. How did your understanding of the official American narrative evolve, and what was it with respect to, say, who was responsible for the 1967 war?
Well, you know, the American administration had been supplying weaponry to Israel way before the 67 war. The principal suppliers were France and Britain. And the United States started supplying them in 1965, all right? And then Johnson administration gave Israel the green light for the 67 war. There's no question about it that there was an American green light for that war, in which they occupied portions of Egypt, the remainder of Palestine, and parts of Syria and the West Bank, which was part of Jordan because of some collusion between the Hashemite monarchy and Israel in 1948. So this was an incredible, devastating situation, and our response was to try to start organizing ourselves to at least to have a certain degree of protection and sanity in this madness in the United States, because the United States press and the politicians were trumpeting this defeat of the Arabs as an American victory. All the press, it was amazing. Gerald Ford said, "This Israel is our battleship in the Middle East," and all of these things, and they were giving, and of course, United States had been helping to fund the whole settlement process inside of Israel and so forth through the tax-exempt status, through the United Israel Appeal and the United Jewish Appeal. So but the principal supporters on the military level before 67 were France and Britain. After 67, the blinders came off and the United States became the principal backers. But during this time, you have to understand that there began to develop a real, genuine, mass, popular Palestinian resistance. And that was with the rise of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Now, but all these reports kept coming out about the torture, about incredible land confiscations, about kicking people out of their homes. All kinds of things were coming out about what Israeli practices. So in 1969, I submitted a resolution to the National Lawyers Guild. I followed all the procedures, sent in a resolution before the convention, and I got to the convention, and whoever submits a resolution had to meet with the head of the resolutions committee, whose name I will go on mention, and she said, "Well, we don't know enough about this. I think better we put table this resolution, and you write an article for Guild Notes about this subject." So I said, "All right, I'll do that," and I wrote this article about Israel's violations of the Fourth Geneva Conventions, and submitted it, and it didn't come out in the Guild Notes. So I contacted them, asked them, "Why didn't you publish this article?" And they said, "Well, we're trying to find somebody to write a rebuttal to it." And finally, they didn't find anybody to write a rebuttal, and they published my article, but with a note in the cover by the editor, who was president of the Guild at the time, that was a disclaimer of any guild connection to this article.
Well, the narrative at that time, which was widely believed, was that Israel merely was defending itself, even as it was grabbing land in three different directions. And that was what you were up against.
You know, I wanted to switch it just for a minute to your the two Arab American organizations that you were involved with. They, too, suffered reprisals, didn't they?
Well, the biggest thing that happened was in 1972, when I was president, U.S. government announced something called Operation Boulder. And Operation Boulder was an interdepartmental, interagency effort to screen all activists on the Palestinian issue in the United States, to screen all Arab surnamed visa applicants before being granted visas to come to the United States, to screen all students, Arab students on the campuses, to contact foreign student advisors on all the campuses. And they were working hand in glove with the Anti-Defamation League, who had been surveilling pro-Palestinian activity in the United States for a long time. They had been keeping files on the United States, and the ADL was working with the FBI, supplying information to the FBI.
Now, the ADL is an establishment Jewish organization.
Yes. So they claimed that they were a civil rights organization, but in point of fact, they ran this spying operation, this separate spying operation in the United States, which finally came to light, actually, in 1993. The FBI is the one that exposed them. In 1993, it's interesting, because they were also spying on anti-apartheid activists in South Africa, and also other people that were
because Central of the American,
because of the alliance between Israel and South Africa. So it was incredible. So we published a small piece in the Sunday New York Times. Is the Nixon administration, it was the Nixon administration that announced Operation Boulder, playing politics with civil liberties. Well, we got called in for an audit on our tax-exempt status because of that. And I, in the meantime, was collecting all these affidavits from all these young Palestinians all over the country that were being hauled in for immigration, deportation proceedings, et cetera, et cetera. And I was just overwhelmed with this work because there weren't a lot of attorneys that were doing work in this area. We got some political support. Phil Hart was a senator in Michigan, and he wrote a very strong letter condemning this dragnet operation by the Nixon administration. And we continued to not really have much impact because at that time it was the Arab was the terrorist. It wasn't the Muslim. It was the Arab, all right? And it was because of the Palestinian movement and the Palestinian struggle that allowed people like Jean Kirkpatrick, who always said that the terrorist movement was being something that was generated by the Soviet Union, if you recall that. They wrote a lot of articles.
And who was Jean Kirkpatrick?
She was the United Nations representative, the U.S. representative to the United Nations. And they were pushing this whole business about the Soviet Union being connected with the terrorism and that the PLO was a terrorist organization, et cetera, et cetera. So this is what we had to face. We were living in, basically, in this situation where Arabs were demonized and so forth. So it got so bad that in the late 70s, the director of the FBI, William Webster, created something called ABSCAM. ABSCAM was an operation in which they dressed up a couple of FBI employees, Italian-Americans, to look like they were Arabs. They wore Arab headdress to entrap certain congressmen who were on the take. So they filmed this and they showed it on the news all the time. So at that point in time, Jim Abarizk, who was really a godsend. I mean, he is a wonderful friend and a wonderful person. He was coming out of South Dakota, this small state. And he was a huge defender of Native American rights. He was a colleague of a real populist movement in South Dakota.
And he was a senator.
And he became
senator.
He had been a member of the House before that, but he became a senator, and he served one term in the Senate. Then he quit. They went after him. They really, when he was in the Senate, they went after him, trying to find some dirt on him and so forth. And they attacked his son, Charlie, who had taken some food stamps. And so they went and used that to try to discredit Jim Abariz. So Jim Abariz had left the Senate, and he agreed to help start this organization. And he came to Detroit. And that's when I first met him, and we had a fundraiser for him when he was running for the Senate, and he got into the Senate, and he was fearless. He was a really it was incredible, because there had been other Arab Americans in Congress. They wouldn't touch this whole issue with a 10-foot pole, but Jim Abariz was fearless. Here he came from this small state. He was not under really any big threat politically in his state. And he started this organization, which I was on the board of, and then I became vice chairman, and then I ultimately resigned from my law practice, closed my law office, and moved to Washington to become the president of the organization.
And that's the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee.
That's right. And I did that for 4 years, and it was like hitting my head against a proverbial wall.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with attorney Abdin Jabara. We'll be right back after this break.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Just joining us, we're speaking with attorney Abdin Jabara. Abdin found a way to integrate his private law practice and activities in support of Palestinians over the last 50 years.
But I thought if we organized this community, they could have some kind of, some, not a lot, but some kind of influence. And we did. We made a big impact on the stereotyping issue. We were able to win battles on that. We actually came in the footsteps of the civil rights movement in that regard. So that was fairly easy. But on the political level, to get politicians, but I had two people that I developed a relationship in Detroit when I was practicing there. One was George Crockett. And the other one was another congressman.
John Conyers.
John Conyers. And we got Arab Americans working on their staff. And when they went to Washington, we were able to work with them to some extent. But they didn't have that much power. The Black Caucus didn't have that much power. But they gave us whatever help they could. John Conyers called some hearings about the attacks that were happening on Arab Americans all over the country, on ADC offices, the assassination of our West Coast regional director, Alex Oda, the bombing of our office in Massachusetts, attack on our representative here in New York. So John Conyers held hearings about those. And then when George Crockett came to Washington, he was a stalwart. He was absolutely wonderful. I remember during the first Intifada, he was a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And he called me up. He said, you know, he says, they're not going to do anything in this Foreign Affairs Committee, but if you get me some witnesses, I'll call, I'll set up a room in the House office building, and we'll have unofficial hearings, and we'll put out a press release about it, which he did. All right? He did what he could do. He knew what the game was in Washington, and I'll tell you, he was one of the most courageous and wonderful people that I've ever met.
Well, he was an African-American congressman from Detroit, became a judge. But didn't he have a National Lawyers Guild flag up in his office in Congress?
Yes, yeah. he was a member of the National Lawyers Guild, as was John Conyers. They were both members of the National Lawyers Guild.
So did this develop into some form of litigation that you participated in?
I've been involved in a lot of litigation over the years, but I am with our deceased and recently departed colleague, Liz Fink, who said there's no justice in America, only the struggle for justice. So I have a very jaundiced view about the value of litigation in achieving justice. Okay. I think that only a mass movement. So I tried, my whole political work was to intersect with other movements that were happening, the peace movement, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, the gay and lesbian movement, all of these different movements, because I thought that there was an intersection in the struggle for peace and justice with all of these movements, and that us working together would make have much more impact than us working separately. So, but I did get involved in lawsuits. One of the lawsuits was when I was with ADC. We found out that the AIPAC had been violating.
What's AIPAC?
AIPAC is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's the principal Israeli or Zionist lobby in the United States, incredibly powerful, with a huge budget and a huge lobbying arm, et cetera. We found out that they were violating provisions of the Federal Election Campaign Act, and we found out that they had set up a whole host of these individual PACs all over the country with nondescript names that were giving the maximum. They would target somebody and have all these PACs give money to the candidates.
The PACs, the Political Action Committee.
That's correct.
So they were able to target people and get them defeated.
Exactly. So we did a lot of research. We studied a lot of reports and so forth and done. And I had a hell of a time finding a lawyer that would take the case. And we finally got the case, and we went to district court. We lost in the district court, and then I and Dan Schember, another Lawyers Guild attorney, asked for an en banc hearing, and we won in front of the en banc hearing. It was unheard of. I couldn't believe it. But there was one judge who was highly respected on that bench who understood what was happening. So he ruled in our favor. The Federal Election Commission, which is it's an old boys club for the Democrat and Republican parties, and they go after the small violators, but not the big ones. And so the Federal Election Commission appealed to the Supreme Court, and it was at that point, only at that point, that AIPAC filed an amicus brief. And what did the Supreme Court do? They remanded the case back to the Federal Election Commission. Well, the Federal Election Commission was the source of the problem. So I can recite other cases that I was involved in and so forth. We tried to challenge the tax-exempt status given to the United Jewish Appeal and United Israel Appeal, and that's another long story. So a lot of my time was doing trying to do basic defense work for people in the movement who were being harassed.
So your interest in joining the Arab American movement and all of the other movements, that kind of developed historically into your work in the National Lawyers Guild, did it not?
Yes, I think both of them actually, went side by side. You know, in 1977, I led the first delegation of the Lawyers Guild to the Middle East. And that was after the Lawyers Guild had adopted 8 questions that all of the chapters around the country were supposed to study. Fantastic questions. They were really on point about were the Palestinians entitled to self-determination? Were the Jews entitled to self-determination? Are the Palestinians entitled to the right of return? All of these questions were ones that were posited by the National Executive Committee for different chapters to study, and they held studies around the country. It was incredible. So after that was done, I took this delegation over there, and we traveled to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and the West Bank and Gaza. We were 10 members, 4 of whom were Jewish, and when we crossed into Jordan, one of the members of that delegation turned out to be an arch-Zionist, and he had a letter that we told everybody to leave everything back in Jordan about where we had been, who we'd visited. We saw Arafat in Beirut, and he had a letter that he had written to his girlfriend with all of this information on it, which the Israelis found. So they singled out 4 of us for a strip search. 3 Jews and me, the 4 of us. We got strip searched. We finally got in. It was amazing. And it was, my goodness, what an experience it was. Oh, my God. We were on the go meeting and talking to people, torture victims. And the stories that we heard were incredible. So we came back just at the time that the Lawyers Guild Convention was being held in Seattle, Washington, just then. And we were all hyped up by this trip. And we go to this Lawyers Guild convention with 2 resolutions, one a political resolution and the other one a human rights resolution. And 2 of the chapters in the guild were opposed to any guild action on these resolutions. And there was one individual, a very respected member of the guild who had been there for many years, who intervened and became a kind of a go-between between these 2 chapters and our delegation, and we worked out a compromise on a political resolution, and which passed, and then, but some people were still not happy, and people left the guild because of that. And Alan Dershowitz wrote a scathing attack on the guild because somebody from the guild had gone to him and told him what had happened, and he wrote in the American Lawyer this article attacking the guild. Then at the next NEC meeting,
Executive Committee.
Yes. They brought up the issue of the human rights resolution, which was a big sticking point because we had put in there systematic use of torture in the interrogation of Palestinians. Well, there was huge, huge fight back on the use of the word systematic. So again, this one individual here in New York who was the go-between, he came in and we came up with some language, I can't remember, numerous instances or something like that, but to try to placate these opponents that denied that Israel could be using systematic torture in the interrogation of Palestinian suspects. So my experience with the Lawyers Guild, and there have been many delegations since that time, there have been many reports since that time, and I can't tell you the respect that I have for this organization. It is, to me, the most principled, it really dealt in the most principled fashion, even though it lost money because of this, even though it lost some members. But you have to remember that I was coming into this work in the Guild at a time when the Guild was changing radically. It was now the new left that was coming in, young lawyers that had come up in a movement and were more conscious of the anti-war movement and more conscious about American imperialism and American involvement overseas, and they made connections in a way that the old line Lawyers Guild had not.
One of the things I've always been tremendously impressed with about you, Abdeen, and because I've been at some of these Lawyers Guild meetings where there was anger on both sides and real differences, but you were able, for some reason and somehow, to remain, you know, not to get angry the way everybody else got angry and to work things out. How do you do that?
Well, you know, I'll tell you how I did it. I mean, I grew up working in this grocery store. One of the things that we were taught is you had to be nice to the customers. And that's what I learned. I mean, whenever a customer wanted this, you'd say, you're right, and you know, and so forth, and you try to work it out. That's really, I'll tell you, if you want to look back and say where I learned to keep my eye on the ball, it was growing up and working my ass off in that grocery store.
Are you active in Palestine solidarity work these days? Abdin, you're 75 years old. You've been doing it for almost 50 years. What are you doing now?
Well, I'm a grandfather, so I'm doing that. I do some solidarity work, but the situation has changed immensely in the Middle East, and I follow it very closely. But I also feel that I've earned a certain surcease in my life, and I want to enjoy my family, my very dear and beloved wife, Holly, and living in New York, our friends here, and all the things that the city has to offer. And that is what I'm most focused on at this point. And as I told the lawyer the other day who consulted me on a case that he just brought, I said, I'm happily retired.
Well, what lessons would you offer young progressive lawyers or law students today about how to chart a progressive and meaningful career in law?
Well, I think the thing is you have to find a balance between making a living and doing political work. That is the key to the thing. You can't give up one for the other. You have to make a living. There's no question about it. And you shouldn't have to starve. You should be able to live a decent life making a living practicing law. But you shouldn't do that to the exclusion of doing some political work. And that could be doing political work through your law practice or outside of the law practice. I did a lot of my political work outside of the law practice. And frankly, what was great about practicing law in Detroit is I had this Arab-American community that supported me. So I didn't have to give a damn about what Joe Blow thought of me or what I said or anything. And the papers, it was amazing. We went to the papers in Detroit and turned them around. We turned them around because we kept hammering them and everything. And we got the Free Press to send two reporters over there that came back and wrote a whole week series about the Palestinians. It was remarkable. And this didn't just happen. And then we worked with, as I told you, with John Conyers and George Crockett, who were leaders in the African-American community. There were people on the Detroit City Council. Carl Levin was one of them. He later became a senator. We got the Detroit City Council to pass Palestinian support resolutions every single year because we held these big demonstrations. When we learned that the UAW had been purchasing Israeli bonds, and when Leonard Woodcock was receiving the Humanitarian...
He was the head of the UAW.
Yes, was receiving the Humanitarian of the Year Award from the B'nai B'rith, we staged a protest in front of Cobo Hall. They shut down lines on the Dodge plant because of absenteeism from the Yemeni workers who came out to support that demonstration. It was one of the highlights of my existence in Detroit, because there was thousands of people out there in front of Cobo Hall when Leonard Woodcock was in there getting this award because of what the UAW had done. And we were attacked by the secretary treasurer of the UAW at the time saying, oh, they're just a bunch of communists that are doing this. I'll never forget that. His name was Emil Mazie.
Abdin, you know, you've always been so non-aggressive in your behavior and kind to people. One of the things that I've always wondered about is once you actually got arrested, could you tell us about that?
I was head of the ADC at the time, and, you know, I was in Jerusalem when the first Intifada happened. And before I went there...
That was in 1985.
1987, actually.
87, yeah.
And I had gone to Washington in 1986. I closed my practice, and I went down there to head up the organization. And the Israelis had announced that they were closing off all entrance into Gaza and not allowing any foodstuff into Gaza or anything. So what we did, we had to do something dramatic. And so I had the staff get some bags of flour and sugar and big 25-pound, 50-pound bags of it. And we said, we're going to go and we're going to dump this right on the doorstep of the Israeli embassy in Washington. Well, there was a law in Washington that you couldn't demonstrate within, I think it was 100 feet of any embassy. So I got four other people who were heads of organizations and so forth to join me. And we went down there and we drove up and and we got out of the car and took these things out of the trunk and went up there and put them on there. And there was these buses that were lined up out there. They had gotten word that we were going to do this. I thought they figured we'd have a lot more people there. We didn't. We just wanted to make a statement. And there was press, and we went up and did that, and then we got arrested and took down and charged and what have you. Ultimately, that whole ordinance was struck down, so we got our records cleared. That's the only time I got arrested. But what we were always trying to do in when I was with ADC was trying to find some kind of way to counteract our powerlessness. We were basically a very small organization with very small amount of funding. For instance, we learned that the Israeli general who had overseen the Sabra and Shatila massacre in Beirut had been appointed as a military attaché, the Israeli military attaché in Washington. And we were outraged that the United States would allow this war criminal to come and be the military attaché for Israel in Washington. So we found out where he lived. We held demonstrations there. We went and brought a lawsuit against him. We put, at the time, you could purchase space on the subway cars, and we got his photograph and put them up in the subway cars with a quote from the Israeli commission that investigated the Sabra and Shatila massacres, and ultimately he was withdrawn from Washington and got some other high position in Israel. So what we tried to do with our limited resources was to find creative ways to somehow highlight these different issues. It was not an easy task, and I got burned out on trying to do that. But it was a interesting experience, and I'm not sorry that I undertook it.
Do you notice, now looking back and comparing your thoughts about how the word Palestinian, or how things are different today than they were when you began this? Do you feel that there's any difference in terms of the temperament of this country when it comes to that?
There's an enormous difference. And I think a lot of it is because now so many Jewish Americans are questioning what Israel is doing and questioning what Zionism is. I think that those are really important factors. We now have some, there's not this unified position in which AIPAC is the only force out there. And we've got organizations such as the Jewish Voice for Peace that's doing marvelous work. All the other alternative Jewish organizations like Brera and so forth, they all came to naught. They were undercut and eliminated. But now we have these organizations that are really doing important work, and I think it's cumulative. All this work, all the work that we did, and all the work that's going on now is all having an impact, all having an important impact. And I'm optimistic, because you can't be involved in this work unless you retain optimism. You have to believe that change is possible, and that's what I believe in.
Well, like our friend Ramsey Clark says, if you don't have hope, you don't do anything. And Abdeen, you certainly have done something. Margaret, did you have something you wanted to say?
No, I'm just, I'm so pleased that I could be here and participate in this. And thank you so much, Abdeen. This has been such a delightful experience for me. And I hope the audience feels the same way.
Abdeen, you are truly a lawyer you'll like. And we're so grateful at Law & Disorder for your coming down and recording this interview. Thank you, and you take it easy, and good luck.
you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.